So if you fancy using the paper Bibles in front of you, that's 1 Kings 18. We'll be talking a little bit about Elijah today. John said, let's consider speaking on encountering God. And recently this had been kind of in my radar, I suppose. And I could think of no better example. I'm sure there's loads, but this has been on my heart. Just going to give you a little bit of background. And usually this is, just to give you a heads up, this is what I do. I like us to read together through the narrative, and we'll pause. And then I'll kind of unpack some things, and then we'll carry on going through the rest of the chapter. So we're not going to read everything all at once. But so that we don't end up reading all of the backstory, I'm just going to give you a little bit of background. So some of the characters involved, obviously Elijah. He's the prophet of God, and he had previously predicted from God 3 years ago, 3 years prior to this, that there would be no rain or dew in the land of Israel, and that was a pretty big deal. We'll see a little bit about that in just a second. So this has been going on for 3 years, no rain or dew whatsoever, and now all of a sudden God says to Elijah, "I'm going to send rain." Now, Ahab, he's the king of Israel. He's the husband of Jezebel. He's partly responsible for where Israel is at spiritually right now. They're worshiping idols. And this is his very first encounter with a prophet of God. And Obadiah, he only turns up just one time. But he is a devout follower of God, but he actually happens to work for Ahab, kind of in the cabinet. So that's where we're at. We've got these characters here. And I've got a video to show you, and this is what I hope will highlight where we're at the moment.
Next on KQED Newsroom, dying orchards, parched fields.
We've got good years and bad years. This is, I call it, worse years. This is really bad.
California's extreme drought and the future of the state's water supply.
Good evening and welcome to KQED Newsroom. I'm Thuy Vu.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. California desperately needs rain. The drought that began in 2011 has grown worse every year since.
And if you have any doubt about the drought's impact, take a look at these pictures. This was Folsom Reservoir in 2011. And this is what the reservoir looked like after 3 years of drought. This was Lake Oroville in 2011. And this is what the lake looks like last year. And this is what the snowpack looks like in 2013. And this is what it looks like just a year later. State officials say the Sierra snowpack is near record lows, and any late season rainfall won't have much of an impact. In the Central Valley, farmers are watching their crops wither, and ranchers are selling off cattle to pay for hay to feed their remaining cows.
I gotta sell more cattle so I can buy more hay.
So the herd gets smaller and smaller.
And I'm getting poorer and poorer.
Farmers who are able to are drilling wells, pumping water from reservoirs.
Right, so that's just to illustrate what the devastation can occur in a drought. Now, this is in California. This is in industrialized United States. It's the most populous state in the U.S., and they are still being crippled by a drought. And you can see what this rancher is saying. It's absolutely affecting his livelihood. And it's becoming almost an epidemic. Still this year, they've not received much rain at all. And yet they have received rain. They have received snow. That snow melts, and it eventually flows into Los Angeles, where people are, you know, watering their gardens pretty much every day. And this is what happens when you build a metropolis in the middle of a desert. But Israel was different. They had not received any rain. They had not received any dew. Imagine what the people are going through just at the moment. They're thinking, it's getting really bad. It's been 3 years. A lot of their economy would have revolved around agriculture as well. Food would be in small supply. I mean, just imagine how bad it would be. So this is where we find ourselves, dire straits. And remember, Elijah is the one who gave the news originally, so he's probably not terribly popular. We begin in 1 Kings 18, verse 15. And that should be up on the screen. Yeah, follow along however you see fit. So, Elijah said, "As the Lord Almighty lives, whom I serve, I will surely present myself to Ahab today." So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When he saw Elijah, he said to him, "Is that you, O troubler of Israel?" "I have not made trouble for Israel," Elijah replied, "but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals. Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." But the people said nothing. Right, so just quick pause. This would have taken a lot of time. This is something I've not really considered before until I really thought about it. He commands the king. He goes before the king and he tells him, and I'm imagining maybe he says it with his finger out or something like that. He says, "Summon all the people from all over Israel and bring them on Mount Carmel." And he says, "Go get the 450 prophets and bring them too." So that takes time. There's logistics involved, and there's the message has to go out. People have to make arrangements. I don't know how long, and I think it's probably best if I don't estimate, but it took some time. So you've got Elijah. He's in Ahab's face, more or less, the king. And he said this with the command of God. God gives him this message to say it, and he says it. But Elijah's human, and I'm going to keep alluding to this all night. Elijah's human. Can you imagine maybe he felt some fear? Can you imagine maybe he was a bit unsure? Can you imagine what that did to his faith as he challenged the king to bring all these people together? And he's thinking, "God, you really need to come through for me on this one. I really need you. God, I need you." He'd be in quite a vulnerable place. So then they all get there. Everybody's come together, and he challenges them to choose straight away. He doesn't mess about. He says, "It's either God who you are going to follow, or you're going to follow the Baals." And there's no in the middle. He specifically says, "How long will you waver between two opinions?" So I get to thinking about idols and idolatry. And for us, I don't know what your vision of this scenario is, where there are maybe wooden idols, maybe they're created idols, or are they all bowing down to these idols? You know, what does that look like? I'm not sure. But we know that we have idols as well. In fact, and you may even know this, but John Calvin, one of the best things I think he ever said was, he said, "Man's nature, so to speak, is a perpetual factory of idols." I think about that. I know myself. I can take something that's really good, a gift from God even, and I can elevate that and put that above God. I always do this. I love my wife, but I'm not wearing my ring. It's really bad. I love my wife. She's a gift from God for me. I love Ashley so much. But if I put her before God, that's an idol. And that's sin. So there can be obvious idols, and there can be idols in disguise. And whatever that is for each of us will differ. It will change. It will look very different for each of us. But we all deal with idols. We all deal with idolatry. So encountering God, how does that look for us? Are we encountering God, or are we allowing idols to get in the way? And that's the story for Israel. That's what Israel is going through just now. They had previously encountered God, and yet they put up these idols and they said, we'll choose these for now. So we move on. In verse 22, "Then Elijah said to them, 'I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves, and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it.' I will prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call in the name of your God, and I will call in the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire, he is God. Then all the people said, what you say is good. In other words, yeah, that works for us. Him versus 450 prophets. Just got three little points here on this that I'm noticing. Him versus 450 prophets. And these are meant to be the ones who make things happen, right? So you're thinking, well, God, he kind of stacks the odds against him, doesn't he? I think God likes unfavorable odds. I think he does. And of course, we know that the Lord, specifically Yahweh here, he says Yahweh. That's the word he used. We know that he is the true God. But for these people, they were thinking, oh yes, surely Baal will prevail. There's 450 prophets at work here against this one guy. It'll be fine. Yes, let's do that. Number two, what you say is good. People want to encounter God. I really believe that. I believe that people who are followers of Christ and even unbelievers, they want to experience God. In fact, it can be a little challenging sometimes, even in youth ministry, because young people are always wanting to experience God, something real, something tangible. And God doesn't always work like that, does he? So it's always worth remembering, though, we want to encounter God. Now, fair point. The God who acts is worthy of our worship. I'll admit, if Baal was the one who showed himself God there, we wouldn't be discussing this. We'd be worshiping Baal. The God who acts, the God who demonstrates himself, that's the one who's worthy of worship. The people agreed with that. They said, yes, this is good. Let's do that. Jesus, he came to earth. He died. He rose again. He sent the Spirit among us. He's at work in us today, tomorrow. Our God acts. I don't know if you've ever seen a miracle, but I've seen a miracle. Little things where we know that God is involved in our lives. God is continually acting. So verse 25. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there are so many of you. Call in the name of your God, but do not light the fire. So they took the bull that was given to them and prepared it. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. Baal, answer us, they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. And they danced around the altar they had made. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. Shout louder, he said. Surely he is a god. Perhaps he is in deep thought, or busy, or traveling. Maybe he is sleeping and must be awakened. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. So that's courageous of Elijah. And we'll talk a bit more about that in just a minute after we cover the next bit. That was courageous. But the real punchline for me is that last verse. I believe it's still up there. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. So I don't know if you thought about an idol that you have, something that you sometimes think about elevating above God, sometimes something that grabs your attention, something shiny. What about when you're in need? Do your idols respond? Do your idols help you? Sometimes we encounter God and it's a result of our idols' silence. These idols, these Baals, they didn't respond. There was nothing. No response, no one answered, no one paid attention. They weren't there. They were not real. They were not acting. They were doing nothing. And these people were about ready to encounter God because of their idol's silence. This has been continually the story in my life. And I'm sorry to admit, I'm sorry to confess that when I have my idols, I encounter God the most when I realize that my idols are not responding to me when I'm in need, when I'm looking for them to speak to me, when I'm looking for them to help me spiritually. They're nowhere to be found, even the ones that are idols in disguise. Because what I yearn for is God. I yearn to experience and encounter the living God, Yahweh. So sometimes encountering God is a result of our idol's silence. Verse 30. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come here to me." They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Your name shall be Israel." With the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he dug a trench round it large enough to hold 2 seahs of seed. It's just a couple of liters, apparently. He arranged the wood, cut the bull into pieces, and laid it on the wood. Then he said to them, "Fill 4 large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood." Time out. Remember, this is a drought. This is a drought. Water is very, very scarce. People will need it to live on. People will need it to irrigate their crops. They'll need it to survive. And Elijah, with what they're perceiving to be a big stunt, we know that's not, but these people were thinking, okay, this is getting out of hand. This is getting ridiculous. Now you want to use the water that we need to live on, and you're going to pour it all over this altar for no reason whatsoever. What are you thinking? I imagine there were people who were just like, yes, he's going to fail, and he's done for. People are going to be so irate that his God has not responded. He's done. We're just going to execute him just now. He's wasted all this water. The people are going to uprise against him. It's over. And yet, after he's taunting them, he's saying, "Use the water." Then 34, "Do it again," he said. And they did it again. "Do it a third time," he ordered. And they did it the third time. The water ran down around the altar and even filled the trench. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, "Lord, Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again." So just a little bit of suspense there. I'm just going to pause again. That courage that we talked about, he's taunting them, right? He's like, maybe your God is asleep. Maybe your God is traveling or busy doing something. It would have smacked of disrespect. And that's what he's going for. He's in their face and he's telling them how useless their idols are and that they're not even listening. He's making fun of them. Now he's got the water. He puts it on the altar. He commands them to do that. And he does it again. And then he does it again. That's a lot of water that's been wasted during this drought. I cannot emphasize this enough, how much that would have angered people. Remember, God promised to Elijah that he would send rain. We didn't read that. That was in the beginning of the chapter. But he says, "I'm going to send rain." So what did Elijah do? He took God at his word. He said, right, God's made a promise. He's made a declaration. So rain is coming. Elijah wasn't worried about the rain. He believed that God was going to send rain. What I think is most interesting is during all of this bit, where he's got this courage to blaspheme these gods that aren't real. He's got this courage to command people to use their water in this way. And then what he does is, I love his prayer. I love his prayer. He says, "Answer me so that these people will know you, Lord." Not so that I'm right and I don't get stabbed to death, and they don't cut me up into pieces because they're angry I've messed up with their water. He says, so that they'll know that you're Lord. I think God gave him the courage to be like that. I've read this years ago, this passage, and I thought, man, Elijah's a man's man. I was actually going to get a picture of Bruce Willis and have it up there so everybody could see, like, man's man, die hard. I forgot, actually. I would have done it, but I forgot. So now you've got that in your mind, Bruce Willis, die hard, man's man, tough guy. I used to think about this passage and go, yeah, that's Elijah. He's like Bruce Willis taking over the Nakatomi Tower like a boss, sticking it to these Baal worshipers. And the more that I've thought about it over the years, I really don't think that was the case. I don't think that Elijah was this big, amazing man on his own. I think God gave him the courage. I think God gave him everything that he needed to be like this, to drive home the point. And I think that Elijah was still very human. I think even though he had all this courage, he still had to choose to trust God. He still had to go, God, if you insist, because he says command here in verse 36, that God commanded him to do these things. God, if you insist, I'm afraid for my life, I'm making a big scene, I'll do what you ask me to do. And so he obeys. Courage, boldness, faith, and obedience. Those things, if we combine these things and we trust in God and God chooses to work in this way, we can experience God in big ways. I know it. I've seen it. And it's fun. Young people, it's fun. When you combine these things, faith and obedience, and you want to magnify God, he does fun things. So he wasn't Bruce Willis. But I have to think, we will not encounter God in these ways if we don't ask. We won't encounter God in the big ways unless we're there and ready to be used. And that's what Elijah did here. He wanted to make his God's name great. That's what he wanted. I think that's the key. He didn't just want to experience God for his own understanding, his own faith even, but he wanted to make his God's name great. So, I'll end the suspense in verse 38. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, "The Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God." Not our Baal God, Yahweh. Yahweh is God. I just got another video. I don't know if this could be helpful or not. About halfway through somewhere. Just take a look at this. We're just going to look at this for maybe 10 seconds or so. That is a fire tornado. That's fine. I think we. Yeah, so just showed you that. Show you what a fire tornado looks like. Now, I'm taking a bit of liberty, okay, with the text here. I don't know what the fire looked like that God sent, but it said that the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice. So it's a physical fire. This isn't a proverbial, like, analogy or something. It's actual fire fell from the sky. God sent it and burned up loads of stuff. The soil, the water in the trench. And God sent that. And it was amazing and it was impressive. I showed you the fire tornado because it's actually a naturally occurring phenomenon. You probably have never seen a fire tornado. I've never seen a fire tornado. I have seen tornadoes. But these do occur. They're rare. I wonder maybe if God took something that naturally happens and made it happen for himself just there. I don't know. Maybe it was a big giant column. I don't know. I don't know what it looks like, but I guarantee you it was impressive. I think that if we had seen a fire tornado like what we just saw on the video, we saw one, a real one, like among us, and it's this massive column of fire, and it's consuming everything, I think we would be pretty amazed. God doesn't do things small sometimes. Sometimes he sends a big fire tornado or whatever he did. He is in the miracle-doing business. He sometimes uses our world around us that we're a part of to do it. God likes to show off. He likes to show his glory. He does it all the time if we're watching. So it burned up everything. Everything, even the water. And the people were no longer upset about losing their water. They were no longer upset that their 450 prophets couldn't get the job done. They knew this was the real God. Wouldn't you? Put yourself in their shoes. Put yourself where they are. And you saw this crazy guy build. Remember, he rebuilt the altar. He built it in such a way that it represented Israel with the stones. And God displays himself like this. So let's carry on just a bit more. Verse 40. Then Elijah commanded them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let anyone get away." They seized them, and Elijah had them brought down to Kishon Valley and slaughtered there. And Elijah said to Ahab, "Go, eat and drink, for there is the sound of a heavy rain." So Ahab went off to eat and drink, but Elijah climbed to the top of Carmel, bent down to the ground, and put his face between his knees. "Go and look towards the sea," he told his servant. And he went up and looked. "There is nothing there," he said. Seven times Elijah said, "Go back." The seventh time the servant reported, "A cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea." So Elijah said, "Go and tell Ahab, hitch up your chariot and go down before the rain stops you." Meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds. The wind rose. A heavy rainstorm came on, and Ahab rode off to Jezreel. The power of the Lord came on Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. So Ahab is in a chariot driven by animals. It's actual horsepower. And the power of the Lord comes on. He does something else. As if God hasn't been busy enough showing himself, he says, "Right, Elijah, you're going to go and you're going to go ahead." And he runs and he beats Ahab there. Obviously, if God can do a fire tornado or a fire column or whatever it is, then a little bit of rain is no problem. Now, Elijah knows this, and yet he's still vulnerable. There's no rain. God said, "Look, I'm going to send rain." And he's thinking, okay, God just did an amazing thing, but he did promise rain. So where is it, God? And I wonder if he was getting impatient. But yet we see that Elijah chose to trust God, even when it was difficult. And you know his servant who had to go and look seven times to see if rain was coming. You know he was getting irritated with Elijah. "Go and look again." "Yeah, I know. I went. We don't know how long the journey is. Maybe it was a bit. Go and look again." Seven times. And the servant says, "Okay, fine." Seven times he does it. Elijah has the faith and the perseverance and the trust in God to tell his servant seven times. What about us? Would we have given up? Would we have said, "I guess God's either not going to do it or now's not the time"? But finally, God remembers his promise, and he sends rain. See, if we went up to Arthur's Seat and we saw a cloud in the sky, we wouldn't be surprised if it was going to rain here. Been a fair bit of that lately. But it had been 3 years. So God promised rain, and he delivers rain. So all this is kind of focusing a bit on Elijah. And we lift up Elijah as an amazing example for us. But let's not forget to elevate God in this. He is the one who encountered the people. He's the one who encountered Elijah. Elijah was used. He was open to be used as a vessel. It was scary. It was scary for Elijah, I'm sure. And yet, he got to experience God in really big, cool ways. Now, just to show that he's not Bruce Willis after all, we see in just the next chapter, after everything that God had done for Elijah over the last 3 years, even in chapter 17, there's some cool stuff in there too. After everything that God had done for Elijah, he cowers in fear, and he runs, and he loses faith. Guys, we're human. Elijah is human. That song that we just sang prior was, I know I make mistakes, I know I'm going to make mistakes, or something to that effect, but our God never fails. So let's remember that. I challenge you guys to think, what are your idols? How do you think you can turn them over to God? And why not us? That's the other thing I challenge you to think of. Why not us? We read about Elijah, and we think, man, that's amazing. I could never experience God like that. Oh, that's amazing. I could never have that much faith. Elijah's just a normal guy. That's really what I've learned from this. He's not Bruce Willis. He's just a normal guy. God never chooses the Bruce Willises. He chooses normal people. We could be experiencing God like that. I'm just going to move into a bit of a response time. What I took away from this was Elijah got to experience God in big ways, but he did it publicly. This is where it gets scary for us, and it's scary for me too. Elijah was very open and vulnerable about everything. And I think that's one of the steps that we can take. Something, a lesson that we can learn from Elijah. So I've just got that whiteboard there, and there's some pens. There's a variety of different ways that you can respond. You can choose to do any of them, some of them. It's up to you. One of them is the journals. If you want to spend some time working on your journal, jotting something down, I don't see a lot of journals just now. But if you could maybe just sit over there, work on your journal for a bit, jot down some notes. You can use that area as a prayer space for what I'm about ready just to ask you in just a moment. Or you could choose to make it public and you could write up there. Now, what I'm asking you, and just take a minute to think about this. What are your dreams that you want to see God accomplish? And think big if you want to. There's a problem, there's something that's not happened yet, there's something that you would like to see in your community, here at the church. What's your dream that only God can accomplish? I'm not just being awkward, I'm giving you a chance to think about it. What is the dream that you have that only God can do? It might be for your family, it might be for Liberton. Could be anything. If you don't have a dream, why not? So once you've got your dream, if you want, you can take a pen and you can declare it. You could write it up there, this is my dream, I want to see. And it's there. It's there for everybody to see. You're vulnerable. It's a bit of a risk. But it also helps us as a church to pray for it. So you've got prayer space, you've got journaling space, you've got up on the platform for all to see your dreams. I'm just going to wrap us up in prayer just for the moment, and then I'll leave you guys to it. God, why not us? Why not us that we could be used like Elijah? Thank you so much that you're faithful. Thank you so much that you're a God who displays himself, that we can encounter you in not just the private, small, sometimes it feels immeasurable, but God, you do work in big ways. You work in public ways. And thank you that we get to experience that and be a part of it. God, help us to remember that Elijah was not Bruce Willis. Help us to remember that Elijah is just like us. And God, give us dreams and visions to share so that when you work and you do something cool, we all will collectively say, that is the Lord who I want to serve. Jesus, thank you for loving us. Thank you for saving us. Holy Spirit, thank you for being in and among us and working through us. God the Father, you're amazing. We love you. Amen.